now for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, up next. Welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. On today's program, we're going to be previewing the Milwaukee Florentine's upcoming production of one of the most popular operas out of the Bel Canto era, The Elixir of Love by Gaetano Donizetti. Before we get to that, I want to remind you that on tomorrow's morning show, we will be commemorating the 100th birthday of legendary filmmaker Orson Welles, born right here in Kenosha. A whole host of exciting events are planned, including a birthday kickoff event at Carthage College in the Student Union tomorrow evening. And tomorrow morning, you can hear my interview with author Patrick McGilligan, a film historian who has done extensive study of Orson Welles, and in particular, his formative early years. So my conversation will air tomorrow on The Morning Show. A reminder as well that The Morning Show is archived on our website, WGTD.org. Click on Talk. That marvelous bass voice belongs to a very talented man by the name of Musa Nukwana. And he is someone who is going to be part of the Milwaukee Florentine's production of Donizetti's delightful comic opera, L'Elisir d'Amore, The Elixir of Love. And he will be performing the role of Dr. Dulcamara, which in many respects is the central figure in this opera and the character who really drives a lot of the comedy forward. But beyond the great humor of Elixir of Love is also the really compelling real-life story of Musa Nukwana, who was born in a township in South Africa and actually born in the midst of his homeland's greatest period of political turmoil. And he writes about that actually in a very interesting memoir called Odyssey of an African Opera Singer from Zuida Township to the World Stage. And I'm very honored to be able to speak with Musa Nukwana about his life and about his performances coming up at the Milwaukee Florentine this weekend. Musa Nukwana, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks for having me.
I am happy to be speaking with you. What I have seen of your memoir, I have found to be very, very interesting. You were born in the summer of 1984 during what you describe as a very turbulent time in your homeland's history, during a period in which there was the rise of something called township uprisings. What was going on in 1984 in South Africa?
Well, you know, at the time of about 2 years before I was born, they had started what was called a tricameral parliament, which means three chambers of Congress. And in these three chambers of Congress were meant to be divided the power of the country and how they were going to rule the country. But the problem with this tricameral parliament was that the black folks of South Africa were not going to be included in these chambers of parliament or Congress, if you like. And so these protests that started from a city called Vaal, which is north of Johannesburg, at least 3 hours from Johannesburg, and they started spreading out throughout the country, and it made things very intense. And so there were riots. I think of now when you read about stories from Baltimore or Ferguson, things to that effect even more so than then. So there were a lot of fighting between the police and the people. And so they affected the country in a very negative manner. And in terms of economy too, it affected it because people were looting, there were fires, and people were dying. Mm. And so I was born amid a very complicated system of politics because people were fighting for equality and things to that effect. Mm. And with the help then of the U.S., in terms of imposing sanctions, it crippled the economy of South Africa because car companies like General Motors, Chrysler, Ford Motor Company started withdrawing from South Africa, which impacted on the economy, which then forced the South African government to have to listen to the calls of the people so that they could have the first democratic election. But yeah, these had already started as years before I was born, but they started intensifying even more so because people were no longer willing to listen or talk. They just wanted to fight. So it was the brink of a civil war, if you like.
You tell us that the house in which you grew up was burned in the middle of the night when you were 10 months old. So, of course, you don't remember that directly, but everybody around you was, in a sense, left with lingering scars of great fear for having barely survived something so traumatic.
Oh, certainly. And I mean, my great-grandmother and my grandmother, who raised me at the time, you know, told me of what happened. And I was fortunate to have picked up on those as early as 4 years old, but to document in my brain what was being said. And then, of course, when I was four, I start to have a little bit of a grasp of how things were going in terms of politics and so forth. But yes, I mean, I was the only one who came out of the ordeal without a scar or something. Everyone else had a scar and all that. I was fortunate because my mother, in trying to break out from the windows when it was on fire, the whole house, she covered me. And thereby, inadvertently, as she was covering me, got burned. Her whole hair was burned, and she had to put on, so some wigs and weaves to cover the whole thing. But I was the only one who came out of the ordeal unscathed, if you like. Mm-hmm. And one of the people who were close to the family and part of the resistance movement, if you like, passed on. Hmm. So, it was an intense moment. Of course, at the time when I grew up, I didn't have a full grasp of what it meant. But now, when I start to think about it, you realize how intense it was.
Hmm. You were not raised by your father. Your father has really not been a meaningful part of your life at all. But you were raised by what you describe as two experienced and loving women. Just say a brief word about the difference that they made in helping you navigate your early life.
Well, I was born in a ghetto because our township to us means ghetto. I realized that when I was writing this book and I was working with a lady, the editor from Iowa, she said to me, well, you need to explain a bit because township to Americans may mean something different. And so you need to say the word ghetto so that they have a fuller vision of the kind of environment you grew up in. We grew up in a ghetto and in the projects, but our kind of projects were brick houses and not big flats where you have like 100 people in one place. It was different houses, so it was a bit better that way. And I was raised by my great-grandmother. At the time I was born, I was still alive. And I had my grandmother who took over her when she passed on at least 3 or 4 years after I was born. I don't remember her much. I mean, I remember a little bit of things, but these were really loving women. What I do remember, though, is that my great-grandmother, you know, as in those days when she used to go in and collect her welfare and pension check, she didn't take it. They didn't use the banking system on those days. So she had to go to the welfare offices, and she would take me along. But what she did in her purse, she put sandwiches, grape juice or orange juice or whatever, and she'll put a little bit of sweet things to her. And the interesting part is that after she had passed on, when they were busy searching through her stuff, they found in her purse exactly the grape juice, the sandwiches and the sweet stuff and chocolates, which she had saved up for me because she passed on, I think, 2 days or a day before we're supposed to have gone for another welfare check for her to collect. And my grandmother, whom her life had not worked out the way she wanted to in terms of her marriage, not far from Durban, which is northeast of South Africa. And so my grandmother took over when she had come back because her mother at the time had gotten sick, and she took over the family. And when I was born, because my mother was so young and my father was not in the picture, in those days, and according to our traditions, the grandparents usually took over. And so when I grew up, I regarded my grandmother as my mother. And I thought my mother was just a big sister or someone in the family. Up until I was finishing high school, started to grasp that she was my mother.
Wow.
But then I still considered my grandmother my mother, and my mother just my biological mother, but we didn't have that much of a close relationship. My grandmother took that spot. And so this lady, you know, took me to school. I remember she did a bit of tricks. She would iron all five of my trousers and shirts for school. You know, we're poor, but out of all the things that we never needed, in terms of school clothes, books for the school, in terms of food, irrespective of whatever we ate, those were always there because she worked three or four jobs just to make ends meet so that we were, I was always taken care of. And so I learned my ABCs from her before I even went to school. And I remember because we didn't speak English at the school I went to, we used our native language. And I was like, oh my God, you know, by now we're approaching high school. And if we finish high school, the English language is not quite there as it needs to be. I'm going to have problems when I need to go to college. So I started to listen to the BBC radio because that's what they played there, and CNN on the TV or BBC or on TV. And, you know, to punish me if I misbehaved, she would give me an English newspaper. So I'd have to read it out loud, the whole newspaper.
Wow.
And it was so difficult. Yeah. I wished at times that she would have spanked me if I misbehaved, but what she did, she let me read the newspaper. And though the stress syllables were always in the wrong places, it took me a while. But she helped me a lot because then I could grasp this language which was foreign to me. It was as much as in South Africa we had 11 languages, which are now 11 official languages. English was still not attainable, especially in the ghettos. So people like that who worked in the towns as domestic workers would speak Afrikaans and English with their bosses. But then the children who never even went to the CPTs up until they were in their high school didn't speak English. So I learned from an earlier stage to try and train myself. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, she gave me her all. You know, she was always there for me. And during spring breaks or winter breaks or some breaks, she took me to her sister's places who lived in the same province or state, if you like, but then a bit further, and they were well off. And so for me, she gave me that hope to know that there was something other than our poverty-stricken background. Mm. There were other places that you could aspire to be in, and all of them were supportive in terms of saying, hey, you need to study. If you work hard, if you study hard, if you don't get into trouble, then there's always going to be something at the end of this tunnel. And so, yeah, that's the kind of relationship I had with my grandmother, a very close one.
In the book, we can read more about your upbringing and how you actually ended up having to look to older boys in the neighborhood in the ghetto to have any kind of male, masculine role models in your life. You ultimately joined choir, mostly because there was a girl you liked who belonged to the choir, school choir, and you thought that might be a means to get to know her better, and that, of course, started you on a long road. It sounds like one of the most important moments for you where you first became very serious in this strange thing called opera was when you were shown a videotape of a Glyndebourne production of Mozart's The Magic Flute, and there in the central role of the high priest Zarastro was a great bass by the name of Willard White, who happened to be black. And I can only imagine what a powerful experience that was for you to see a black man in an important role in an opera, of all things. Just how important was that for the life path your life
very
took?
Very important. Oh, it was extremely important, as you pointed out, because we just sang choral music, and I sang for fun as a kid. I joined the choir because of the girl, because I didn't have any other means of reaching out to her. But then when I got into the choir, that didn't quite work out because I was still this macho boy, you know, who learned from other boys in the ghetto, but I didn't learn the right manners, the right way to talk to women, so that fell through. But nonetheless, the most important part, I think, was the fact that I realized that, you know, let me remain to the choir, because there were girls in the choir, and our choir master was a woman. And so I learned a lot from her, because she would chastise me if I misspoke or didn't speak in the right way with girls or her. So I learned from her, too. And when I was in high school, then I continued singing with the choir. And when I saw this video, which was referring to this 1978 video, a friend of mine who was quite older than me was at the University of Port Elizabeth, showed me this video. I said, "I thought, what is this?" He said, "It's opera." But what? And I said, "Tell me what is it?" He said, "Look, opera is not so different from what you do, choral music, except it's it's drama and music. So a combination of these two on stage." I said, "Well, it looks like a play." He says, "Yeah, you can think of it as a singing play, but in a foreign language." And so I thought, "Is this Afrikaans?" They said, "No, it's not Afrikaans, it's German." And so I started reading the encyclopedias about what German is and who Mozart was and so forth. But as much as this interested me, what drew me in was seeing this black dude in the middle of this production. Because I didn't think that was possible. At home, we didn't sing this kind of music. And I think even people who did want to sing it, they were not allowed to, let alone going to the theater to watch it, because the country was still heavily segregated. And so for me, it was not, or the rest of us, it was not something that was possible. We always thought it might have been some Eurocentric thing. But then when I saw this black person doing this major role, you know, and in England, I said, "Oh my God, I gotta do this." I love singing. I think I know I might have joined the choir because of a girl, but you know, I really love singing, and that changed my life, because throughout high school I was still mesmerized by this whole thing. And when at home they wanted me to study medicine or engineering, my heart was not in it at all. You know, that picture of that 1978 bass from Jamaica singing, I was like, "I'm in." And so there were World War III at home, because, you know, back and forth with my grandmother, they thought I was trying to give up, or they might have thought that somehow the ghetto had influenced me, because it was a norm. You didn't finish high school. Those who finished high school would go to college, although if they did go to college, most of them didn't finish. Or others, when finishing high school, they wanted to work and didn't want to go to college. So I did go to college and do 2 semesters of civil engineering, and we did very well there in terms of classes and grades. The problem is that we couldn't afford it. And at that time, my mother had my little sister, who's 12 years younger than me. And because of that reason, you know, we couldn't do anything. She had to send my sister to private school, and it was just going to be difficult for her to do that and still pay for my education. And at the time, my grandmother had retired from working, so she, with her little pension money, she could not really, you know, support me in that manner. And we didn't have what we call trust funds or in retirement funds and so forth. It was just from paycheck to paycheck, whatever money she had managed to save. And so because of that reason, I focused on music. So for about a year and a half after dropping out of college, my focus was on one thing, singing. And I write a great deal then on my book about the struggles that I had, but then I still had that picture. You see, amid the problems and troubles that we had, I still had the objective. I said, "Okay, I want to be like that dude. I want to be in central figure on stage. It doesn't matter. And it would be nice if it's a multiracial cast or whatever, but I wanted to be on stage, and that kept me going.
Hmm. Well, we can read more about the amazing journey that you have made to now this upper echelon of the world of opera, in which you are a proud national winner of the Metropolitan Opera Auditions, the recipient of all kinds of other awards, a proud graduate of several different schools, including the Academy of Vocal Arts in Philadelphia, one of the premier schools in the country for classical singers, and of course now singing on all kinds of important stages, and making your Milwaukee Florentine debut this weekend in the role of Dr. Dulcamara in Donizetti's Elixir of Love. I've seen a little excerpt from a production from earlier in your life, I believe, when you were at school at the Academy of Vocal Arts, and you are in this role and obviously relishing its comic possibilities. I think it's kind of interesting thinking about the fact that what inspired you to opera was watching something as serious as Zarastro in The Magic Flute. There's nothing funny about him at all. But here you are in a role like Dr. Dulcamara. Just say a word about the fun you seem to have doing comedy on the opera stage.
Well, you know, I as you said, the first thing I watched was a very serious opera. And when I went to college in Cape Town, the University of Cape Town, I still studied a serious opera. But then in my third year, and we were starting to do roles, the first role they gave me was Leporello in Don Giovanni. And I was like, wait, what? And I didn't realize that I could do comic operas because I'm a serious person. I'm like, and I'd like to do serious opera. And so when they gave me that, my professor, who's from Milan, but who grew up in South Africa, said, well, you have an ability to do both serious and a comic. And you operas, and you don't realize that you can do comic without even thinking about it. You can easily adapt, and so then when this possibility of doing Dulcamara, who, because you know, as much as he's a funny man, the singing is still serious. He considers himself very serious, which is an interesting part. Everything he does, he's like, I'm serious, and then but he's funny. And the singing, though, can be also difficult because he has all those high notes, repeated E flat to Fs. And, you know, there are many comic bases who try to do the role, but singing-wise, it's always difficult. Since I'm in the lyric kind of bass, and then to do this role, but combining it with the acting and so forth, it makes it a very interesting part for me. And so I'm excited then to be debuting with Florentine Opera. And what I like about it is that it's in the Midwest. People are so nice here, and I've managed to like work with amazing colleagues from different states, but they might as well be from Milwaukee or anywhere in Wisconsin because they're so pleasant.
Hmm.
And then working with the stage director, who happens also to be the general manager of the company, Mr. Bill Florescu, it has been so pleasant because he gives you the idea of what he would like you to do, or the greater vision, and then he gives you the freedom within it to do as you please within the framework of what he's asked for. Hmm. So it makes things collaborative for all of us, and so being able to try out things. And Dulcamara, I must say, in this production, is very funny. He stands out. He comes up with a suit that is so bright. He looks like a pimp from Detroit in the 1960s. And I'm bald, so they've let me not wear any wig. They just want me to go bald. So I'm like, yes, it's a great win for me. But I usually, you know, never win that argument. I always just wear wigs. So this time I'm not going to wear a wig.
No wig.
I'm very excited. No wig. Natural as I am.
Well, I know a lot of people are looking forward to this weekend's performances and are excited about your presence in this cast. At the Milwaukee Florentine Opera, performances this weekend of Donizetti's comedy, The Elixir of Love. And people are invited to go to the Florentine's website for more information, florentineopera.org, or they can call 414-291-5700 for more information. And again, the name of Musa Nkwana's memoir is Odyssey of an African Opera Singer, From Zwide Township to the World Stage. Musa Nkwana, a great pleasure for me to speak with you today on The Morning Show. Very best wishes to you and all your colleagues in Elixir of Love.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me, and greetings to your listeners, and thanks for them to listening to us.
All right, there we go. That was really fun. I'm glad we got to do that.
All right, thank you so much.
Okay, you bet. Best wishes to you.
All right, thank you, sir.
Yeah, bye-bye. For the Milwaukee Florentine Opera's upcoming performances of Gaetano Donizetti's delightful comedy, The Elixir of Love, in the role of Nemorino, the charming country bumpkin who wants so desperately to win the hand of the beautiful Edina, we will be hearing tenor Rolando Sanz, who has performed the role of Nemorino any number of times to great acclaim, and brings his beautiful voice and elegant artistry to the stage of the Florentine to take on this role. And I'm excited that we have a few minutes to speak with Rolando Sanz about Nemorino and some of the beautiful music which this character gets to sing. Rolando Sanz, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
And I'm sorry I don't have this information right in front of me. Can you remind me if this is your Florentine debut or if you've been part of the Milwaukee Florentine before this?
I'm very lucky to be back for my second time with Florentine Opera. I was here last season as Alfredo in La Traviata. So Milwaukee is very quickly becoming a second home.
Very good. I very much wanted to see La Traviata, but it was impossible for me to do so. I had two different voice students in the chorus of it, and that, for that reason and others, made me want to be there badly, but couldn't be there. So I'd forgotten that you were the Alfredo, and delighted that you are back in Milwaukee. One of my first questions was going to be to just have you tell us a little bit about yourself, and actually one of the most important things for us to know is that you are from Baltimore, Maryland. We, of course, would be amiss if we didn't at least acknowledge that the beautiful city of Baltimore is really undergoing something very, very difficult. And I'm sorry that you have to be viewing what you are right now. Those unhappy events, are things okay back home in terms of any family you have there?
In fact, Baltimore is obviously going through a really tough time right now, and it's a true testament to the amazing city that the citizens of Baltimore are gathering their forces, and it's always been a great town of culture and beauty and art, and it has. I'm born and raised in Maryland, and so while it breaks my heart to see on TV from here in Milwaukee what everyone else is seeing, I have no doubt that Baltimore will come through and triumph. And one of my greatest joys is actually I've sung the national anthem for the Baltimore Orioles for their opening series the last handful of years, and it's an amazing city, and I'm very proud to be from Maryland, and I have no doubt that things will pull through.
Hmm. Well, we're glad that you can at least be amongst friends and as collegial a scenario as the Milwaukee Florentine, which I know does all it can to take care of its singers. And you, of course, are part of a really fine, fine cast. Say a quick word, if you would, about when and under what circumstances singing first became very important to you. At what point did it become a really serious pursuit for you?
Sure. I remember singing from as early a memory as I have, and one of the formative experiences I had was I was always kind of this precocious kid that was singing and wanting to be on stage. So my wonderful father, not having a clue what to do with his kid, saw an ad in the Washington Post that the Washington Opera was auditioning for their children's chorus. And so he said, well, this is a good way to let this kid go run around the stage. And so I auditioned for them, and, you know, kind of begrudgingly, because what 11-year-old kid wants to go be in an opera, of course. But I found myself getting accepted, and while all the other kids were running off to play cards backstage and goof off, I found myself just off stage left staring at these aliens on stage singing with the orchestra, and I got hooked from then on. Just hoped that my voice would one day develop to be able to perform in that way, and very luckily it has.
Hmm. Have you always been a tenor?
I have not. I started off in undergraduate as a baritone, not a good one, you can say, but one nonetheless, and slowly built my voice up to tenor land where I live now.
And of course, among the many roles which you have sung, I'm not sure a role has been more important to your career than that of Nemorino in The Elixir of Love. Tell us about the first time you undertook this role.
The first time I studied scenes from it in college, as many students do, and that was kind of my first foray into really learning an extended 20-minute scene of opera. And then I was lucky enough to get my feet wet in the role in Boise, Idaho, of all places. They have a wonderful opera company there, and they took a chance in a relative unknown right out of school, and got a chance to perform it there. Learned that it's very quickly on stage that it's a pretty tireless role for the tenor at for everyone, the tenor specifically in this opera, really doesn't leave the stage that often. So it wasn't until I had done it all the way through in a full production that I said, wow, that's a lot of notes in one evening.
I'm glad to hear you say that, because the school where I teach undertook a complete Elixir of Love last year. And it's one of those things where when you just sort of listen to it, I think it's a combination of the elegance of the music and the fact that it's a lighthearted comedy can sort of mislead one into underestimating just how arduous it is, especially for the tenor. As you say, that's a really, really big role. And a tenor that survives and thrives in singing it has to have a really good technique at their disposal.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a true test of control of one's passaggio, because as we've been saying in rehearsal these last couple of weeks, I mean, this role for the tenor sits on F, which is right in the middle of the passaggio all evening. And the second part of it is also having just come off of a couple of traviatas where the drama, you know, kind of leads and the orchestra really leads in setting the tone for the evening. This is really a lighthearted comedy, and it's the old saying that drama kind of does itself, but comedy's really hard, especially while having to sing in your passaggio. So it's that constant battle and that constant balance, but we're having a blast.
Tell us about the famous aria Una Futiva Lagrimar, which you have the privilege of singing. It's certainly the most famous musical passage from this entire opera, and indeed among the most famous of all tenor arias. Describe it to our listeners and what makes it especially beautiful and also maybe especially challenging.
Well, the Una Furtiva Lagrima is what we call the 11 o'clock number in the show. We've had a lot of romping around, and Nemorino's gotten quite intoxicated a couple times on stage already, and he's been pining after Adina all evening, following her around like a little puppy dog. And suddenly, this elixir seems to be kicking in, because all the girls in town are suddenly throwing themselves at him. Unknowing to him, his rich uncle has died, and so they all know that he's quite wealthy. But in his world, it's the magic elixir that's taken effect, of course. And so we're very close to the end of the opera, and there's been jubilant music all throughout. And suddenly, we hear for the first time in the evening the harp. And the harp starts those beautiful arpeggios at the beginning of the aria. And then we have that classic bassoon solo that introduces the aria. And Nemorino finds himself for the first time in the opera completely alone on stage. And what's interesting about this aria for me is that it sounds quite melancholy and it sounds quite brooding, when in fact, because he finally realizes that all these girls are throwing themselves at him, but it's really Adina is the one that he wants. And so it's interesting, because if you close your eyes and listen to the music, you would think that it would be a very sad, introspective aria. And the real challenge of it is delivering the aria with a smile, because it's really quite a happy, transformative aria for Nemorino.
Tell us about the experience of being part of this cast, and how important it is to have good chemistry with one's castmates when you're in an opera like Elixir of Love.
Sure, it's a great question. Going back to how difficult comedy is, it's all in the timing. And so, not to take away from more dramatic operas, but more dramatic operas really have a lot of help from the orchestration and the mood that's set and the dramatic pauses that composers like Verdi and Puccini put into the score. It's naturally there. With something like Donizetti's Elixir, it really requires a lot of interplay of the characters off of each other. And comic timing and right time and not cracking each other up. And it's really important to have a really talented cast who's very quick and can really play off of each other. And we're very lucky in this production to have that with our cast.
Before I let you go, I want you to say a word about something that I know is very important to you, an organization called Young Artists of America, which you co-founded with your brother. What is the purpose of that organization?
So Young Artists of America, we founded that in Washington, D.C. about 4 years ago because we saw that there was a lack of opportunity for both young instrumentalists and young singers to come together and put on really high-quality performances, which they get to collaborate on the repertoire. We found that my brother, Christopher, is the music director of the large youth orchestra in the D.C. area. And that organization focuses on the big symphonic repertoire for these young kids. They play a lot of Beethoven and Mozart, and it's wonderful, that meat and potatoes. But what they were lacking in their programming was these wonderful pieces of repertoire that involve singers, so oratorio and some opera and some really large-scale music theater like the great works of Werther and Lowe. And that's one side of it. The other side is that I personally never got a chance to sing with a full symphonic orchestra until I was in almost graduate school. So we really wanted to give these young singers that are in high school really trying to find their way into the arts of what they want to major in and what they want to study, to give them an avenue to be able to experience these big symphonic sounds and to work together on these great works. So that's how the organization was founded. We've been very lucky in the past 4 years to invite some amazing guest artists like Jason Robert Brown from Broadway to work with our kids. And it seems like the organization, they're very proud to be able to give back to my community in Washington, D.C. through this organization.
Very good. In the meantime, I know a lot of people are looking forward to these upcoming performances of Donizetti's delightful Elixir of Love and to your performances in it. Rolando Sanz, I thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show. Very best wishes to you and all of your castmates.
Thank you so much, and we'll see you at the opera.
Now we're going to be speaking with the woman who is portraying the object of Nemorino's affections, namely the beautiful Adina. And portraying Adina for the Milwaukee Florentines production of Elixir of Love is soprano Diana McVeigh, who has been with the Florentine before. She was an absolutely enchanting Countess Almaviva when the Florentine did Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro. And I know a lot of people are excited to see her back, this time in the role of Adina, in this gem from the bel canto era. Soprano Diana McVeigh, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you. It's so good to be back in Milwaukee.
It's a great place, and it's a great opera company, isn't it?
Oh, my gosh. I'm thrilled to be back here. You know, this company is envied by many around the country. So when you're rehired at a company like this, you know you're doing something right.
Right. And, of course, because they have a relatively modest season, that is, with not all that many operas, it's even more of a compliment in a sense when those few coveted starring roles, you secure one of them.
That's exactly correct. Yeah, it's a little feather in your cap when you can do that, that's for sure.
Very good. Before we talk about the role of Adina and this particular opera, I wonder if you could just say a word about, first of all, where you come from originally.
I come from Rhode Island.
I don't know how many people I've ever met who come from Rhode Island. It's, of course, a modest place, but it plays an important role in our own country's history. Tell us more about your years growing up in Rhode Island and at what point singing became so important for you.
Well, there was always music in my family. My mother played piano. Two of my three sisters sang and had scholarship offers to go to school for music, but they turned it down. And when my mom died, I was 12 years old, so I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. So I was sort of leaning toward doing something in the science field. And then in high school, when I thought I was pretty settled on entering underwater research, my high school choral director said, "I think you're making a mistake. I think you need to go follow this music path." And so at a very late date in my senior year of high school, I decided I wanted to go to school for music. And I originally went into music and studied percussion. And it was halfway through my first semester there that someone said, you should also try singing. So then I became a double major in percussion and voice. And then toward the end of my career in college, I figured, I don't want to carry timpani anymore. I don't want to carry any sort of equipment anymore. I just want to go sing.
So that's what made you discard percussion as much as anything, all the heavy lifting.
The heavy lifting, and, you know, I loved the singing, but, you know, the percussion thing was even more challenging than the singing thing. There are even fewer jobs for percussionists. And I just didn't have the same kind of passion for it that I did for the singing.
Hmm. I wonder, when you were doing both seriously, how did they each differ from the other as an experience for you? I mean, for instance, just as a musician yourself on a very personal level, or did they very much feel like the same expression, but it was just one of them was with your own voice and the other was banging on things in the percussion section?
Well, they complement. For me, they complemented. And it being a percussionist really solidified my musicianship skills, being able to count, being able to read, which in some cases, singers are notoriously the worst musicians.
Right.
If they haven't had any kind of instrumental background. Now, that's a pretty broad brush. That's not everyone, but it tends to be the case.
Well, and it's certainly the myth. I mean, it's certainly a widely held belief that there are a whole lot of singers in the world who don't know how to count. They maybe do other things very well, but that's often the Achilles heel of even really talented singers.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and, you know, myths come from somewhere. but the percussion really did solidify my musicianship, and it helps me learn very challenging roles very quickly because I don't have to spend a lot of time, you know, plunking out notes.
So tell us, once you embarked on a really serious pursuit of a career in singing, what did you do first, or how did you go about pursuing such an interesting dream?
Well, first, out of college, I wasn't sure that I wanted to sing professionally. I wasn't sure that's what I wanted to do full time. I still wasn't sure how to go about it. So I took a job with the Rhode Island Philharmonic, which is the professional orchestra in Rhode Island. And I was the director of education for 6 years. And then one day at dinner, my husband said, hey, why don't you quit your job and go sing? And I thought that was a little odd, so I asked him why. And he said, because there has to be something better for us to talk about at dinner than how much you hate your job. And he was right. I was miserable at my job because I wanted to go be a singer. So another really well-known soprano in the business, Maria Spacania, is also from Rhode Island. So I contacted her and I said, may I have a few lessons and pick your brain on what needs to happen here? And that's been a very long-standing relationship. I still study with her even though she lives in Pittsburgh.
Wow.
So she sort of started me on the path, giving me the ideas and the information I needed to embark on a career.
What has been the most sort of pleasant surprise about what this life is like, and also what has been maybe a challenge which you did not fully anticipate?
Well, they sort of go a little bit hand in hand. The pleasant surprise is all the amazing people you meet along the way. We're all doing the same thing, and so in a way we're like-minded, but in a way we're all so very different. We come from very different backgrounds, and we have very different goals and focuses, but I've met some of the most incredible people. But with that comes the part about having to be away all the time and be, you know, living out of a suitcase and in different hotels and hopping on planes. And, you know, and some of these people that you spend a very intense period of time with, you know, 2, 3, 4 weeks, you get to know someone pretty quickly because you're doing such a very intense thing, sharing emotions. And then suddenly you leave and you may not see them again for 3, 4 years. So with social media, it's a little easier now to keep in touch with people and remain, have the relationship remain intact. But it's still, sometimes it's a little bit bittersweet.
Sure. The Elixir of Love, the opera in which you're singing with the Florentine, is from the period of opera history known as Bel Canto, which of course means literally beautiful singing. Mm-hmm. Tell us what you most enjoy about singing in this particular operatic genre.
Well, it's very, very challenging. It requires you to have a very solid technique. You can't have any holes in your technique. And you have to have incredible breath control. You have to be able to spin a phrase, spin gold. And typically, the tunes from this era are beautiful, and they're so gratifying, and the score is so fun from start to finish. Even the slow, beautiful parts just have this unbelievable energy to them, and it's just fabulous singing when the role is so gratifying from start to finish.
Hmm. Tell us about the character of Adina. She is a really interesting character. I mean, even beyond the beautiful music, which is given to her by Mr. Donizetti.
Yeah, she is very interesting. She's also a bit of a challenge. And the reason why I actually fully accepted doing Adina here with Bill Florescu and the Florentine was because of Bill's particular take on this character. So often she's portrayed as a very mean, kind of ditzy, flighty kind of person, which she is not. And so many times she's not likable because of the take that a particular director has on her. But Bill's take on Adina is brilliant, but it's also challenging to try to pull it off. She's really not mean. She just has lived a life, and she doesn't, you know, want to go backwards in any way, shape, or form. And she sort of finds Nemorino to be needy and clingy, which she doesn't need that. She's a landowner. She owns and runs a vineyard. She's responsible for all of these workers. The last thing she wants is a needy, clingy man. She wants somebody who can stand on their own two feet and help.
Right.
So she is a challenge, but it's a fun challenge.
Right, and it sounds like this particular take on her is one that you feel really comfortable with, and so you're probably enjoying this production of Elixir more than maybe the typical one.
I think so, and I think the audience will enjoy it more, and they're going to get a special take on it, and I think Bill's take is brilliant.
Tell us about this particular cast and how important it is for you to have really strong affinity and empathy with your castmates in an opera like Elixir.
Oh, it's paramount. You know, this kind of this kind of opera, there are a lot of interjectory kinds of things. It's not everybody sings for 5 minutes and, you know, somebody else sings for 5 minutes. There's a lot of interplay. And your colleagues have to be, you know, very prepared, very good. They have to be understanding of what's happening, and they have to have a very good understanding of their own role and how their role affects the other roles. And my castmates in this production are just brilliant. Mm. I really adore them. I had only worked with Corey McKern before, so Musa and Rolando were new to me, but I'm very much enjoying working with them.
Cool. Because I guess that's one of the big question marks when someone has a career like this, is that when you head off to the Milwaukee Florentine or Opera Idaho or wherever it is you happen to be singing something, that's kind of a wild card. Who are your colleagues going to be in this particular production, and are they going to be people with whom you can work easily and comfortably and ultimately successfully?
Yeah, there's nothing worse than having to, you know, work with a tenor that you abhor and you have to convince the audience you love.
That's when your acting ability comes into full view.
That's right. You block everything out and you just play love. That's all.
Right. Well, it sounds like things are shaping up for a very, very fine production of this delightful opera by Donizetti, L'Elisir d'Amour, at the Milwaukee Florentine. And in the role of Adina, Diana McVeigh. Diana McVeigh, thank you for making time for this conversation in your busy schedule, and we hope you and your castmates have a very successful series of performances of this delightful masterpiece from the Bel Canto era.
Thank you so much for calling. I really appreciate it.
Una furtiva lagrima negli occhi suoi spuntò, quelle festose giovani invidia sembrò.
Donizetti's Elixir of Love is going to be performed this weekend at the Milwaukee Florentine. You can call them at 414-291-5700 or go to Milwaukee Florentine for more information. Tomorrow on the morning show, Patrick McGilligan, film historian and a great authority on the life of Orson Welles, will air our interview tomorrow, which marks the 100th